Thanks a lot. Also, thanks for the kind introduction and obviously also for the invitation to speak. Yeah, I'm very happy to present this work. Also, because I mean, there was obviously a lot of work that was also poured into this. So right now, I'm very happy to talk about the finished product. Yeah, and I hope you can also take something out of this. And so if you have any questions, please just like interrupt me, ask along the way. I like also to keep my talks as informative, informal as possible. So yeah, but yeah, without further ado. So this is based on our recent preprint, Quantum Metrology in the Final Sample Regime, with these excellent people, with Sumit, Daniel, Jens, and Philippe. And Philippe was also the one who had like this very initial seed idea that led to this project. Just wanted to mention that. I also put a QR code, but that will reappear at the end of the talk again. And I would also upload like a PDF of those slides on my webpage, so for your further reference. Okay, so, but before I get into the details of the paper, I just wanted to give like a quick recap of what quantum metrology actually is. So basically, metrology is like the scientific study of measurement. And this is like a very physical thing, you know, like we are in this like, not weird, but like nice intersection between physics, information theory, computer science, math. And but like metrology at its core is like a very physical thing. So it's really about like physics and like building quantum sensors where really you are like, okay, what is the magnetic field, right? So something which is like very hands-on in a certain way. But another way of seeing quantum metrology is what people call quantum parameter estimation, where you say, okay, you have some sort of quantum system where some kind of parameters encoded. So for example, you have a parametrized state or something like this. Yeah. For me, quantum metrology, quantum sensing, quantum parameter estimations is essentially like the same thing. Yeah. Some people will kind of claim that there are like fine nuanced differences between those, but I'm not a believer in these kinds of distinctions. Yeah. And when we call it quantum parameter estimation, we are already like at a higher level of abstraction in my mind, at least, because like now we are already more talking about like mathematical objects. And this whole theme of quantum metrology and quantum parameter estimation, it obviously also works if there are multiple parameters, right? If you don't want to, for example, estimate like a magnetic field, but all the components of a magnetic field is like a vector, right? Or if you say, yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of parameters people usually care about. But I think if you push this to the extreme, you can also ask yourself, okay, what if I want to estimate all the parameters of a quantum state? So if you really see a quantum state as like a matrix and the parameters are like the literal entries of the matrix, and what you get then is like tomography, right? So also tomography is a task which is very fundamental to quantum information science, which can also be understood through the lens of quantum metrology. So I think I just put this slide to motivate that quantum metrology is like a very broad field that is kind of like touching all sorts of areas of quantum information theory. Okay, so and how do theorists go about this in a traditional setting? So basically, what I will do now, I will assume that there is like some sort of parametrized state. So if I say to you, oh, maybe you want to measure a magnetic field, assume the strength of the magnetic field is now a parameter called T. Yeah, I just like call it T because it's a little bit more intuitive for the rest of the talk. But what you did like physically is you prepared a quantum system at a certain state, then you let it evolve for some fixed time, and then kind of depending on the strength of the magnetic field, you get a different state out. But right now for the theoretical treatment of this talk, I will assume that this process has been done and we are just like given like a family, a parameterized family of states. And essentially the task is if somebody gives me like a description of this family of states, that I'm to design like a detector, yeah, a procedure, a protocol that measures these states out and produces a prediction of what the actual encoded parameter, in our case, I will always call it time B, right? This is value T. Okay, and on a theoretical level, we can always model this as a POVM. You know, like every POVM effect, this can also be like continuous, right? It's associated to one particular prediction. And then if I want to see what the probability of a certain prediction is, I just check like the underlying ground truth, ground truth, rho of some t against like this Pyrian effect. Okay, so I hope this is like theoretical setup is clear. And then in the traditional approach, what you want is an unbiased estimate. So the idea is you want that if you repeat your experiment like a gazillion times, you want to be extremely sure that the estimate you have is true, right? It's like the correct value. So in expectation, you want the estimate that your PUVM produces to be the true value of the parameter, and it should have like low variance, yeah? Because variance is kind of like a proxy for mean squared error in this case. And this variance, you can lower bound it to the so-called Kramer-Rao bound, which is like the one fundamental tool that people use in studying quantum metrology. Yeah. So this variance is lower bounded by the inverse of the so-called quantum Fisher information. The quantum Fisher information is like a measure of distinguishability of nearby states. Yeah. So how can we define it? So one way to do is to say, okay, if we take the fidelity of states at rho t and rho t plus some perturbation tau, yeah, then the second order contribution to this fidelity will scale with the quantum Fisher information, just like for you to see how this quantity actually arises. And the thing is that this approach has some, you could say, downsides, because it's inherently asymptotic. Yeah. So first of all, just like the left-hand side of this bound is like this variance. Yeah, variance in itself is a property that is like, yeah, it's like an expectation value kind of. So it's like something that carries information about like what happens if you do your experiment infinitely often in a certain sense. And the same is also true for the right hand side, because this Fisher information is like kind of like an infinitely precise approximation of your state. So if you look at the fidelity, and if you zoom in as much as you can, then you will see kind of the action of the quantum Fisher information. Next, this quantum Kramer-Rao bound also assumes that this parameter that we want to estimate is already approximately known. This is also why on the right-hand side, the Fisher information at the true parameter value appears. Yeah. So this is called the local estimation scenario. And hence, it can be difficult to justify the application of this quantum Kramer-Rao bound in this finite sample regime that we care about, where we say, okay, what if we only do like one repetition of this experiment? How well can we estimate a parameter? Or if we do like five repetitions, I don't know, but just like not an asymptotic amount. Okay. And to motivate this a little bit more, because like last time I gave this talk, there were a lot of questions about this, I want to give like a small example. Yeah. And please tell me after the talk how enlightening you found this. Yeah. So let's say we do the following. We have Alice, and she prepares a plus state, and she lets this plus state evolve under a phase Hamiltonian, so like kind of Pauli Z. And then this plus state obviously rotates on the equator of the Bloch sphere. And then afterwards, she sends it to Bob via a channel that's completely defacing it in the plus minus basis, so the eigenbasis of the Pauli X operator. What you get out is like a density matrix, rows of T, where you're just like kind of oscillating on this line in the Bloch sphere between the plus pole and the minus pole with like a constant frequency. Yeah. And you can compute the quantum Fisher information for this. And it's one, except at the two poles of the Bloch sphere. Yeah. Where it vanishes. Yeah. This is just because at these points, the first derivatives vanish. Yeah. So this is like, where you already see that like the Fisher information behaves a little bit weirdly, but because as soon as you like have that the derivative vanishes, yeah, hell kind of breaks loose, because you get this discontinuity. And actually, the nice thing about the Kramer-Rao bound that you see on this slide is that it can actually be saturated. Yeah, so we know that we can kind of make up an observable that achieves this variance, and this means that this Kramer-Rao bound, and this is also very much the appeal of this traditional approach to quantum metrology, it kind of reduces the task of like establishing how well you can estimate a parameter to calculating one number, which is this quantum Fisher information, right? And so this is kind of nice. And actually, to come back to the example, we know from like the theory of this quantum Fisher information that we can find an observable T in this case, such that the expected value is the true value, Yeah, so it's like unbiased. And the variance is achieving the Kramer Rao bound. And now the problem in this setting, for example, arises when we go to small t. Yeah. You have to believe me if I say to you that this observable has eigenvalues which go like t and 1 over t, and they occur with probabilities O1 and OT squared for small t. Yeah, you know, like this O1 is coming from the cos square term, which is like in first order is just like constant, and the OT square is coming from the somewhere else. No, wait. Yeah, it's coming from the sine square, exactly. Yeah, so this is where like these probabilities come from. And what you see is that you have this first eigenvalue of this operator appearing with constant probability, but like it's OT, so the estimate will be OT. And the other one is 1 over t, but it occurs with OT squared. So also if you multiply it out, you also get OT. So you get this prediction that you want, right? An expectation should be OT. But to actually see the second outcome, yeah, the second outcome that kind of balances our prediction of the parameter, you have to take order of like actually 1 over t squared samples. I actually made a typo in there. Yeah. So what this means is that if you look at this particular observable, which manifestly saturates this Kramer-Rao bound, and is therefore in this traditional sense optimal, yeah, to actually see these or gather enough information about the parameter, you have to, for small t, measure a diverging number of times to actually see the informative outcomes, yeah, of this measurement, because otherwise your estimate will always be kind of too low in a certain sense. Now, so I mean, this is also like a theoretical thing, right? I mean, like these observables, usually it's very hard to measure them and blah, blah, blah. But this should just like motivate you that you can just like construct examples which do not really look so outlandish, where this fish information stuff is getting problematic. Yeah. And it usually has something to do with like vanishing first order derivatives of like this date curve in a certain sense. Okay. Whew. So, if this was like the traditional way of going about this, you know, all this quantum Kramer-Rao bound stuff, then the question obviously arises what we do instead. Now, if we care about the single shot theory, and we take the same setup. Yeah. So again, we have like a parameterized set of states. We are tasked with designing a protocol, i.e. a POVM that gives us estimates of the actual two parameter. And now, instead of looking at unbiased estimates, we ask, okay, is the estimate within a certain estimation tolerance delta around the true value? Yeah. And if this is the case, then we call our estimation a success. And if it's not the case, we say it failed. Yeah. So this is our new way of saying what is a good estimate is one that is very successful on average. And so the question we ask ourselves is, what is the probability of successful estimation in this setting where we put like this tolerance parameter? Now, okay, and this is already kind of going into a direction where it's much more reminiscent of learning, because I mean, if you kind of think about like the theory of machine learning, there you always have these like puck definitions, right? And what's the probability that your estimate is approximately correct? And this is the exact same spirit, but now applied to this like setting of quantum metrology. Okay, and now I ask this question of what is the probability of having a successful estimation in that sense? And then the question is obviously probability with respect to what? Yeah. So, I mean, there must be some randomness involved. And we have like two ways of like going about this. And the first thing is where we say, okay, we have this like parameterized set of states, these rows of t's. And then we just say, okay, maybe we have some prior knowledge about how these t's are distributed. So what is the probability that I get a certain ground truth from this particular set? Could also be that you already did some experiments. You might have like a peaked Gaussian prior where you have a good idea in which neighborhood the value of a parameter actually is. That could be something like this. Yeah. And if you now go forward with this, we have the set of states, we have the POVM, and then we can quantify what the probability of a successful estimation actually is. And this is the following. So first of all, let's see if I can make this laser pointer thingy work. So here, if you see it, yes, you see it, very good. So here we have this set of states, rows of t, we have the POVM queue. And then what we actually do is like we take every ground truth T. It happens with a certain probability, which is embodied by this measure mu of T. And then for every such ground truth, we just like take everything in the minus delta to delta neighborhood, like this, the one where it's actually considered a successful estimate, and just like take all the probability mass that the POVM assigns there, right? So this is really the probability conditioned on the ground truth actually being T that we have a successful estimate, and then we just like take the expectation over the prior distribution for the ground truth. Okay, let's see if the good. And this is what we call the Bayesian success probability, because I mean, it's very Bayesian, and this is kind of like the expected success probability that you have when you have this knowledge, this prior distribution knowledge. Yeah. But you can also as well ask yourself, okay, but what if I don't want to assume a prior distribution, right? Every time you assume a prior, you put some knowledge in, even if it's like a uniform prior, even that is kind of an assumption that you put. Yeah. And I mean, there's this notion of like a least informative prior, for example, but still it's a prior. So it represents some degree of belief that you have about the distribution. And sometimes you really want to not do this. Yeah? So we have also a second way of viewing this, kind of this like single shot metrology, by considering what happens if we have an adversary that picks the state from the set against us, right? Where you say, okay, what is really the worst that could happen? Yeah. And what you get in this case is what we call the minimax success probability. This is kind of the worst case that could happen. And it's just like the same expression on the left, but instead of like having this expected success probability over the ground truths, we take the minimum. Yeah. Oops. I'm destroying my office here. Okay. So the thing is with this minimax success probability is actually kind of a nice thing, because it really fundamentally captures this idea of I have no clue what is going on with my parameter. Yeah, so I have really no prior knowledge. And so this, because it's something that you can always guarantee. So no matter what's going on in my distribution over the t's, this like minimax success probability is eta bar, I can always guarantee. So it's like a much more fundamental way of treating this idea of not knowing what the parameter is. Okay, so these are like the two main themes that we also treat during the paper. In the following rest of this talk, I will more talk about this like the right side, this minimax quantities, just because the ideas and theorems are usually a bit easier to present, yeah? Which is kind of nice, because usually minimax quantities are harder to calculate, but in our case, it turns out it's just like much easier to handle. Yeah. Okay, good. I showed you this like success probability definition. I hope I motivated it in a reasonable way, because it kind of now captures this idea that no matter what my row of T looks like, it could also be like n copies of the same state, right? Which you would then use to understand how it goes towards the asymptotic regime. But this is really a definition that works in the single shot in the finite sample case. So it's like a really like a new way of viewing quantum metrology, and we use this to actually build a whole framework that we call now the PAC metrology framework, probably approximately correct metrology. And the first pillar I already showed you is the success probability, which answers the question, what is the probability of obtaining an estimate within a fixed tolerance? You know, the tolerance was this parameter delta that we kept fixed. But especially in metrology, you can also ask the reverse question, where it's like, okay, if I say I want to have a certain fixed success probability, well, how small can I choose this tolerance while still guaranteeing this, right? So it's kind of like the reverse thing, where you say, okay, I want to optimize the tolerance, make it as small as possible, but I want to have a certain probability that my outcome is correct, for example, 0.99 or something like this, right? If I fix this, how small can I choose my tolerance? And this tolerance is kind of important in our setting, especially in metrology, because it is conceptually much more related to like a standard deviation, which is the thing that we bounded in the Kramer-Rao bound, right? Variance standard deviations, kind of the same thing. So These are usually the quantities that people care more about in metrology. And having presented these two things, yeah, where I say either I fix the tolerance and say how successful can I be, or I fix the success probability and say, okay, how small can my tolerance be? You can also say, yeah, good, but what if I want both, right? If I want to have like guarantees on both the success probability and tolerance, and then you naturally come to the question of what is the sample complexity? So how many copies of a state do I need to guarantee both a fixed success probability and a fixed tolerance? Yeah. Okay. And these three quantities, yeah, both in the Bayesian and the Minimax setting, I only presented now the Minimax ones in this slide. These form this framework of PAC metrology. Yeah. And this is what we will analyze in the rest of the talk. So obviously I showed you this definition. Yeah. And this definition works for any kind of POVM. Yeah. So for every kind of POVM, you can assign a success probability. And then the obvious thing you ask yourself, okay, but what is the best I can achieve? Yeah. So what is, if I optimize the success probability, in this case, I put the Minimax one over the POVM. And this optimization is actually nicely behaved because it constitutes a so-called semi-infinite program. Yeah. And you can just like think of it as like a continuous semi-definite program, an SDP. Yeah. I mean, there's some mathematical technicalities involved, but if you just like think of this, like it's like an SDP for your intuition, it's fine. For the people who don't know an SDP, this essentially means that we can efficiently compute this quantity efficiently in the dimension of the variables, which are matrices and of quantum states, so it's exponentially, but I mean like in principle efficiently. And having these like programming formulations, semi-infinite or semi-definite, they give you a handle to establish good lower and upper bounds, because these programs, yeah, for every program that maximizes something, there's a so-called dual program that minimizes something. And those guys, in our case, they meet because there's no so-called duality gap. Yeah. So this is here. But this we can use to use educated guesses for example, a good POVM or like a good dual variable to get like good bounds upper and lower on this quantity. And in the paper, we also generalize this whole notion of optimization also to the case where we don't have a parameterized state, but we have parameterized quantum channels. And there we can optimize over coombs, yeah, or even like indefinite causal order strategies. Yeah, this is like a little bit of like a model for like adaptive processing, so to speak. Yeah. So the idea that if you have a channel, you can prepare a state, let it pass through the channel. Then you have like a memory system. You interact with the memory system, do some processing. Then you interact with the channel again, and so on and on and so on. And this whole process can be modeled by a quantum comb. And we can actually also optimize over combs because they constitute like a convex set. Yeah. So we also have all these extensions for these like more complicated settings. Yeah. And what we also have in the paper is we give like post-processing strategies for fixed measurements. So what does this mean? You know, like as theorists, I think we always like to imagine like this imaginary practitioner, the famed experimentalist that will one day apply these theories. And what I imagine is that in the lab, sometimes you have constraints. You already have like a fixed measurement apparatus. For example, you're an optics person. You can only do homodyne detection. And then you ask, okay, what if I do only homodyne detection? What is the best way of post-processing the outcomes of my homodyne detection into actual predictions? And we can also tell you that. Yeah. So there you can essentially do something which is a little bit like maximum likelihood estimation. And it's obviously optimal. No? Yeah. Let me drink a bit. So before I come to the next topic, I just wanted to say that like from this nicely optimizable quantity, this like optimal minimax success probability for our metrology problem, we can also obviously define stuff like the optimal tolerance or the optimal sample complexity just by saying, okay, how small can I, for example, make the tolerance while still optimizing at every step, so to speak, the sample complexity to still be over a certain threshold and the sample complexity, success probability. Yeah. So we inherit also optimized versions of all the other quantities that I showed you in this PAC methodology framework. Good. Next. This was all just like more or less establishing like a framework, saying how we would like to treat metrology from like a different angle, where we now also are valid in the single shot regime. And we also have shown how optimization over like the protocols can be carried out in like a very structured and good way through the semi-infinite programs. And I think the core contribution of our paper is now to relate all of this to hypothesis testing. And I will actually be able, because it's not so hard, to be honest, to present you one of the proofs, or at least like the idea of one of the proofs of the key contribution of the paper, which is like a reduction of, from this like this notion of quantum metrology to hypothesis testing. So imagine you have a metrology problem where you have like a parameterized set of states. Yeah, and this is like the parameters now T, and you might have like certain let's say like this. If you're given one of these states, let's say rho of T1, and you have like a PUVM Q that produces estimates, like this T hat, which is now represented by the green dot, yeah? And you put these deltas in here, then you know that the probability that this T hat that your PUVM produces is within the tolerance is at least this minimax success probability, just by definition of the minimax success probability. And this also holds for all the other states on this line, yeah? Because the minimax thing is like a worst case thing, so it holds really across the whole board. Yeah. So I could also write Ti in this expression here. And now I will just like forget that this is a metrology problem and say, what if I just look at the multi-hypothesis testing problem between these three states? Now, okay, this is also like well-defined, like if you get one of the you're getting like this set of three states and you're tasked with defining a measurement, a POVM, that tells me which of the three guys it is. Yeah. And now, having had this like change of perspective, we remember that this was like a metrology problem all along where we had these tolerances. Yeah. And we've chosen, or I have chosen for the sake of this presentation, that these things are more than two delta apart each, so that these like tolerance regions, they don't touch. Yeah. And what I can now do is I take this POVM for the metrology problem, I measure it, and then I just predict the closest Ti of these three guys to solve my hypothesis testing problem. Yeah. And with this strategy, because these like tolerance regions, yeah, they don't overlap, I know that the probability that this particular way of solving the hypothesis testing problem is correct is at least the minimax success probability of the metrology problem. Yeah? And if we now know that the multi-hypothesis testing problem cannot be solved with a certain success probability, this also has to hold for the metrology problem. Yeah? And for this argument to work, it is important that these tolerance regions don't touch, right? Because otherwise I could not be sure which of the two guys it is. Yeah. Okay. So what the theorem is that we conclude from this is that essentially we can upper bound the minimax success probability of the metrology problem by the minimax success probability of the hypothesis testing problem between states whose times are at least two delta apart each, right? So I hope that was relatively clear, because the idea is relatively simple. It's really just like using the POVM that does the metrology problem to solve an associated hypothesis testing problem. And because the hypothesis testing problem is hard, the metrology problem also has to be hard. So this is the logic. We also have like a Bayesian version of this, which is much more ugly because of Bayesianism. We have extensions of this to channels as well under different access models. Yeah, so this is really taking our framework and connecting it to hypothesis testing. And the cool thing is now, we can use this whole toolbox of hypothesis testing, of reductions, of lower bounds, of Fanon's inequality, whatever, to get like bounds on the best achievable performance in quantum metrology. Okay, good. Having cleared out this hypothesis testing thing, we next come to this like estimation tolerance. Yeah. this is like what I told you before, like this delta quantity. Yeah. So far we have analyzed this success probability with a fixed tolerance, but as I motivated to you already, we are often also interested in this reverse problem where we say, okay, how small can I make the tolerance while still guaranteeing a certain success probability? Yeah. And the math on this slide is just like doing what I just said to you, right? You make the tolerance as small as you can while still maintaining that the minimax success probability is not getting smaller than a certain value at each bar. And because this quantity is conceptually like the standard deviation, we also would like to have something that resembles the standard Kramer-Rao bound. Yeah. I put it here again. Yeah. I mean, now I took the square root such that in the end, we don't have the variance of the left hand side, but the standard deviation. But we really have this form, standard deviation, lower bounded 1/√ of the Fisher information. And in our paper, we make use of this reduction to quantum hypothesis testing to actually prove that we have something similar. Yeah. At least in the form, we have that this tolerance, this like estimation tolerance, also the optimized one, is lower bounded by something that now has the minimum Fisher information over all of T in the denominator. And in the numerator, we see a new dependence on the success probability that we desire, right? This is something that is not present in the Kramer-Rao bound, because this is like a bound on the variance. An asymptotic object, there's no probabilities involved a priori, right? So in principle, this is like a new feature. And in this bound, so first we have this dependence log 1/(1−eta), which is kind of like log 1/(failure probability), which is like a scaling that you would expect in these kinds of bounds. And we have this Q factor here. Yeah. I mean, I don't have to have half hour time that I would need to motivate to you what this Q is. It's kind of like if you have a look at the paper at some point, if you just look at the text, it's relatively clear, but you have to do some lines of math to motivate what it does. Yeah. Basically, what I can say to you is that in the IID setting, yeah, where instead of rho, I take rho tensor n, this Q factor scales as like 1/√ of n. Yeah. So here we really see that we have an explicit correction that's stemming from this like finite sample regime, which is kind of cool in my opinion. So we really have something which is like a finite sample analog of the Kramer-Rao bound for this quantity delta, which is much more much more difficult to treat. So I think that was kind of like a success that we had with this connection hypothesis testing. And I don't want to just like not show you this like definition of sample complexity. It essentially is also what I already told you about before. It's like, okay, just like to flash a definition, right? So you take this sample complexity, you take n, you try say, okay, I fix both like this success probability and the delta. And then I say, okay, how large do I have to, or how small can I choose the number of copies such that I can guarantee both of these things, just to flash a definition. And now, before we take too long, I want to give you one example that we did. Yeah. And this is phase estimation. So this is like a very prototypical application of quantum metrology, because many things, everything that evolves under a unitary or so, is kind of like a phase. So phase estimation is very crucial. And what we look at is the local evolution of an ensemble of spins under the same phase Hamiltonian. So what I depicted here. So you have like spin systems, and every single copy evolves under the same Hamiltonian. Yeah. And we choose a Hamiltonian such that, or let's say in our case, we just like take a phase Hamiltonian set half. And what this does is that the Hamiltonian of the joint system kind of has like only integer frequencies. Yeah. This means that we essentially get this covariant set of states. So it kind of has a recurrence time of 2π. So we really have something that is like a very well-behaved object. In our case, it would be like a representation of U1 and these kinds of things. So it's like a set of states that arises from this kind of evolution has a lot of structure that we can exploit. And this really large amount of structure allows us to determine what the optimal measurement is for determining like the parameter T in this case. And it is what you would guess. It's like the pretty good measurement. Yeah, the pretty good measurement is just like choosing the POVM effect for every time t proportional to the state at time t. This is essentially what you could say. And we show it's optimal for the minimax setting, and we even have a closed form solution for what the minimax success probability actually is in this case. Yeah. So we have this quantity that normally would involve like an optimization over POVMs. And we just like showed that like what the optimal POVM is, put it in and managed to squeeze out like really a closed form solution for this quantity. And in this setting, in this formula, we just assumed that the Hamiltonian decomposes as a sum over lambda the eigenvalues and pi lambda some eigenprojectors and the input state to the whole thing, like across all the, let's say, n copies of the spins, has like amplitudes psi lambda relative to these eigenspaces. This is like what happens in this formula. And you see like this minimax success probability for this particular very symmetric setting is kind of like a quadratic form, in the amplitudes. Okay, so, and what is cool about this is that now that we have a closed form solution for the optimal success probability, so for every possible input state, we can start optimizing over the actual input state. Yeah, so actually, we are now going away from solving the problem for like a parametrized set of states, but actually for this parametrized set of channels, which are the unitary evolutions under this particular Hamiltonian. So we really say we already determined the optimal measurement for every input state, and now we also optimize over all the possible input states. And then this allows us to give a comparison of probe states for quantum metrology. So that's what I said. And two of the things that we want to compare are first like a GZ-like state. So you really take like the lowest and the highest energy state in this setting and compare them. And you also take a Holland-Burnett state, which is just like a superposition of all the energy eigenstates. Yeah. So the thing is that naively, or like in traditional quantum metrology, the GZ state is the optimal state for estimating a phase, just that because it's most susceptible. Yeah, because one of the two states will accrue a phase with like a factor of n in front and the other doesn't. So you really have like a quick accruing of phase between those two. And I mean, it's relatively easy to classically show this is optimal. But the thing is, like in this classically traditional approach to quantum metrology, this is local estimation, where you assume you already kind of know what the true parameter is and you also only want to suppress small deviations around it. But in our case, we have this minimax setting. It's worst case over all the possible values 0 to 2 pi of this parameter and this GZ state, because of this factor n, if we go from t from 0 to 2 pi, it will round n times the whole parameter range because the recurrence time is shorter. So you cannot resolve anything with a in a larger interval as between 0 and 2 pi over n. Yeah. So for high n, you expect that this the precision achieved by GZ actually degrades. Yeah. It's like if you want to tell the time of the day, if you only have like one of these clocks that trainers use when, or coaches use when they are running 100 meters, right? So if you do this, then you have this like second clock. And if you only have the hand or the clock for the seconds, telling the time of the day is kind of difficult. And this is like an analogy why we think the GZ state doesn't work so well. And instead, this Holland-Burnett state would be where we have all the hands on the clock that we could have. Yeah, so we expect it to perform better. And now I just give you some plots. Yeah, so we plotted the success probability for fixed values of this tolerance parameter. So first for a relatively large value, and we see an exponential decay. Yeah. So this is the optimal achievable value. We see an exponential decay. And at the beginning, at least, here's the same. It's just like a little bit less fast because, I mean, the tolerance is smaller, so we don't expect it to work so well so fast. And we see that this Holland-Burnett state is the orange one. It's actually performing quite well in a wide parameter range. And we also see the red line, which is have a success probability of, or this is actually failure probability, sorry. I'm plotting failure probability. That I should say, yeah. So failure probability is 1 minus success probability, and this Holland-Burnett state, this GZ state has failure probability essentially 1, as I just like motivated to you, and it also falls out of like the numerics, right? And as a comparison, this blue thing is the optimal thing. So the best thing I can expect. And this green thing is like the best thing that I can do with product states. Yeah, so I really see like a different scaling. And this is also something we can prove analytically. Yeah, what the asymptotic rates of decay are for these curves. It's kind of neat. And we can also do this plot, or actually, I mean, you might ask yourself what the optimal probe set is, and it's complicated. Yeah, so there's work in the 70s in signal processing where they essentially determine this, but I won't get into this too much. No? You can also plot the reverse thing. Now, where you say, okay, you fix the success probability to a certain value, and then you ask, how small can I choose this tolerance parameter? And there, you can see some hallmarks of like quantum metrology, what people usually care about is stuff like, for example, the standard quantum limit. It happens for this green curve, which is like the best achievable thing with product states. So it's really a 1/(n) scaling for this tolerance. And you also see the so-called Heisenberg limit, where you have a 1/(n) scaling, yeah, that you can achieve with the optimal state, sometimes also with this Holland-Burnett state asymptotically. No? So this is kind of neat that we can really reproduce phenomena that we also see in this traditional theory of quantum metrology in our framework. And what I also don't want to care on the rug is a comparison with the quantum Kramer-Rao bound in this setting. Yeah? So first of all, I mean, this is the plot, and the success probability that I fixed to is now ((1/)√2). Yeah, this is the probability for like a perfect Gaussian distribution to be like in the 1 sigma interval. So this is kind of what we use to kind of go from this idea of standard deviation to something comparable to our tolerance parameter. And we actually see that we have like a constant size gap here between the optimal entangled thing and the Kramer-Rao bound, a very large gap between what the GLZ state does and its Kramer-Rao bound, and a very good agreement for the product state thing. Yeah. So it's actually an open question that we still have is like, when is this Kramer-Rao bound actually working well, and across what range of the success probability is it actually comparable to our estimates of what the achievable precision is? Yeah. Also, I think the Kramer-Rao bound in this setting works so well because it's highly regular. You remember this phase estimation setting was super symmetric. It's only pure states. So in more irregular scenarios, I expect these plots to also look markedly different. Yeah, just as a disclaimer. Oh, well, yeah, I hope you're not too much fed up with this yet, but I'm coming to the end. So obviously, this is a paper which has many, many pages, and we do a lot of other stuff. So first of all, we also connect our quantities to single-shot entropy measures like conditional min entropy. So you can see this like optimal success probability also as a certain conditional min entropy. Then, as I already told you, we have this hypothesis testing connection that we also lift to quantum channels with different access models, adaptive, non-adaptive, causal superposition, and so on. Then we have many extensions of this. Yeah. So for example, the most prominent one is this multi-parameter case. So where we really say you just have some arbitrary space that parameterizes your states, it can be whatever. Yeah. And you have some distance measure on that set of states or on the set of like parameters. And then you can just like do the same reductions to hypothesis testing, for example. And this is also where this work connects a lot to, for example, learning. Yeah, where you say, okay, you have something encoded in quantum states, something that you want to learn. And then if you have some on the thing that you want to learn, if you have a distance measure on this, you can use our constructions, our lower bound constructions, to reduce this directly to hypothesis testing. So this is a little bit like indirect because it's like a paper about quantum metrology, but essentially the tools, they also apply to other scenarios. Yeah. So for example, you can also think about like Hamiltonian learning as something like this, where you say, okay, you have a state, you let it evolve under an unknown Hamiltonian for a fixed time. Then you have at the end something that is parameterized by the actual Hamiltonian. Then you can say, oh, I want to know Hamiltonians up to a certain infinity norm distance, for example. And then you can say, okay, what is my success probability of getting such an estimate? And what people usually care about in this setting is sample complexity. Yeah. So these things that we have, they really connect also to those scenarios and also the reductions to hypothesis testing do. Okay. And we have an overview of open questions. And there are really a lot of open questions in this field because we are essentially kind of having like a parallel development to all this established literature, traditional literature of quantum metrology. So we really, all the questions that have been answered in the last 40 years in quantum metrology, they usually have an analog in this setting, in this finite sample setting, single shot quantum metrology setting, PAC metrology setting. And most of these questions are actually just like wide open. Yeah? And the question is like how to ask those questions properly in our setting, for example. So it's like there's really a lot of stuff open, and I want to present you some. So one direct question that we ask ourselves is obviously, can we have good lower bounds on the success probability? So can we have good out-of-the-box protocols? Yeah, for example, it's pretty good measurement, worked well in this very symmetric case, but like proving some general statements with it is like a real pain. Yeah. Then can we have better versions of this finite sample analogs for the Kramer-Rao bound? Because we really believe that like we don't have like the perfect lower bound yet. Then we really want to understand what the advantages of adaptive processing and entanglement are, right? For example, we know in metrology, adaptiveness doesn't help you asymptotically, but we expect that in the finite setting, it should help you, yeah? So this is also something we really want to understand. And then there's also this idea of like mixed asymptotics. It's more like an information theory kind of thing, where we ask ourselves, okay, if I want to have my tolerance scale in a certain way, 1/4 root of n, something, I don't know, yeah? How fast can I make my success probability achieve 1, right? Something like this. It's a little bit like also strong converses and information theory in the spirit, yeah? And something I also care about is to understand, okay, how do noise and error correction fit into this picture? Because we have a picture for error correction for metrology, which works in the traditional setting, in the asymptotic setting. But I think this picture hinges a lot on the fact that you're only looking in one point in parameter space, where you say you have like kind of one tangent that, in parameter space or in state space that represents the signal. And if your noise is not in the same direction, you can kind of recover. But I mean, is this really the same in our setting? How does it really work in the finite sample regime? How much errors can we correct? Yeah, so it's, I think it's a very interesting question. Okay. And with this, like all the talking, I want to come to a quick summary. Okay, so what we have are new tools to understand quantum metrology in the single shot regime. Really something that is not only valid in the well-explored asymptotic regime. And I also showed you this connection to hypothesis testing. And this means also, this is working because the whole framework, this PAC metrology thing, as we called it, is very close to quantum information theory, both in the theory and in the results, yeah? For example, in the paper, we also compute what the asymptotic rate, or at least get good bounds on what the asymptotic rate of quantum metrology is, for example. It's a very info-theoretic question. And then we have this plethora of open questions that I just showed you, and they are really, you can ask them for very practically minded things, things that are relevant for people in a lab, to something which is only pure information theory, really like these asymptotic rates. Yeah, so it's like an extremely wide range. And I think this whole whole framework just like forms an exciting opportunity to explore these new directions in quantum metrology and to kind of retrace like kind of the paths that already have been taken in this field, like all these results that have been developed, all these like restrictions, all these possibilities, the advantages of entanglement, of maybe non-causal things, all of this, analyzing this in this new light, I think it's just like super exciting. And also not only from like a practical perspective, but also like it's mathematical, just like it's just like nice to do this. Yeah. And with that, I thank you for your attention. I know it was kind of long. I will, after this talk, put a PDF with the slides on my webpage. And I also put a QR code for the paper, for the archive version. And with that, I mean, if you have questions, I'd be very happy to answer them.
Clapping here, but it's mostly online. And so there's lots of clapping emojis, I'm sure. Yeah, let's please get any questions for Johannes. Okay, so maybe while people think of some, I wanted to come back to, so you had a motivating example where essentially like your variance diverged when the like the QFI went to zero, but like only at these like specific points. And then I guess this is a problem, but then I was wondering in the new bounds that you provided, you had sort of an inverse scaling with like the minimum over the Fisher informations for like this minimax setting. And like you would think this would still be a problem, like the original problem would still be there when you like went in this finite sample regime. And so yeah. Like, yeah, I guess my question is like, is it like realistic just to assume that the worst case like QFI over the parameter region is just not zero or not too much smaller than the average case? Or how do you deal with this?
So I mean, basically, I think like if I paraphrase, like you saw min of t of ft, and you say, what if ft is the minimum of zero, right? Doesn't that diverge? Is that not bad?
Some point, yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, I mean, I obviously didn't give you all the fine print of these statements, which means kind of like that, like this kind of bound, like this finite sample Kramer-Rao bound, assumes that like this expansion exists in the second order. Yeah. So I mean, like it's kind of like a circular statement. But what you can do is you kind of, I think in this setting, you can just like punch out like these two points from your parameter space. And in our setting, it doesn't really matter so much, right? So you just like ignore these two like, points in your parameterization essentially. And it doesn't really hurt so much, yeah? But obviously, it is a very good question of like how problematic this really is. And actually, I don't have a good answer for this because, I mean, we spend so much time on the math and less on like, oh, let's find a very good example where everybody will be convinced that this is a cool idea. Because like, I mean, I think it's cool just like from the math perspective alone, and I don't need to motivate experimentalists to work on this yet. Yeah. But, I think a good image to have in mind for like parameter estimation with Fisher information is that Fisher information based or like this Kramer-Rao bound, it's kind of associated to a Gaussian distribution. So basically, this is kind of like maximum likelihood estimation, and maximum likelihood estimation works well if your data is distributed like a Gaussian. So a little bit like this, that's like the spirit. So you imagine if stuff is kind of Gaussian, then it works well. The converse of this is if it's not looking like a Gaussian, it might not work so well. Now, if it's like very wiggly and you have some other points which are also very probable but far away, then these things tend to not work so well anymore. And I think in these examples that we've seen, yeah, they are still relatively symmetric. There's a lot of structure. They are well defined. There's like this, you can just like, for example, in this covariance setting, you can just like shift your parameter, everything looks the same. Yeah. So there I expect that you don't have like these very rugged things which are not looking like a Gaussian. And actually this parameter Q that I didn't explain to you, it kind of measures how close you are to this Gaussian setting. Yeah. And that's also why you expect this 1/√n kind of theme, which is kind of like a Barry as seen type approximation thing. Yeah. So it's like there's a lot of stuff going on under the hood, also on the understanding side, that is also still kind of open. Yeah. I mean, like kind of we wrote 107 pages about this, but we only barely scratched the surface of what interesting questions are lurking in the dark, so to speak.
Very good. Okay, so we are getting kicked out of the room. I'm not sure if the Zoom call will stay alive till after that, but we can try to continue. And if it dies, then let's thank Johannes one more time, just in case.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. And I mean, I know this is like not so close to this whole like learning theory crowd, but maybe I can motivate you to just like have a quick glance at our theorems. And we also have something in the appendix for these like arbitrary parameterizations and like really these like reductions to hypothesis testing, where also especially in this Minimax case, this is like a generic thing. And this also applies to these learning settings. And just to look at this, I think that would already be interesting. It could be potentially helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much again, Johannes.